Welcome to the March 2022 Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast, in which Dr. John Challice addresses the topic Cathedral Folly, the Origin of the 1960 Plan to Build a Brutalist-Style Cathedral at New Norcia. Dr. Challice is introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody.
Today's speaker is an old friend, Dr. John Challice, and he asked me to remind everybody that he has already appeared before the ACHS in 2017 when he talked about recollections of a movement chaplain in Perth, 1952 to 1958. And he was born and educated in Perth and came to Sydney from the junior seminary in Perth, which was fed into St. Patrick's College here in Sydney. When he came, he doesn't say this in the briefing notes, but he blitzed everybody in philosophy and caused a certain amount of disarray in the pecking order of the way students perceive themselves. But he was ordained and went back to Perth, and I can remember that he went to see Archbishop Prendeville, the Archbishop, and said, "I'd like to do a PhD." And Prendeville said to him, "I didn't pay all that money to turn you into an academic. I need parish priests." And John wondered whether he was in the right outfit. So he joined the Dominicans in Melbourne in 1958 and was awarded a doctorate in theology from the Aquinas Academy University in Rome in 1962. He was in Rome at the time of the first session of the Vatican Council. He then joined the religious broadcast department of the ABC and later moved to the science unit, where he succeeded Dr. Pockley, who was the founder of that unit. And I think that was when I first met John. He then became director, head of that department, as I say, and although he doesn't say it, he moved to, essentially to be a kind of plenipotentiary at large for the ABC. He was constantly attending meetings of the European and Asian broadcasting unions. He was a kind of a roving diplomat for the ABC. John says, following his retirement from the ABC, he has continued his lifelong interest in architectural history, particularly of 20th century cathedrals. And he's modified his title slightly. He was a victim of COVID in the sense that he had to be rescheduled to this year because he didn't particularly want to participate in a Zoom session. So he's retitled today's talk, Cathedral Folly, singular. He decided that there were so many follies in Australian potential and real cathedrals that he couldn't deal with them all in one session. And he's talking about the origin of the 1960 plan to build a brutalist-style cathedral at New Norcia. Now, many people in this audience would need no reminding about the importance of the Benedictines in Sydney, Poulding and Ullathorne and so on. But there are also Benedictines in the West, except they came from Spain. And that's very different. Another example of the way in which the West is different from and sees itself as different from us in the East, we Easties. That should deter me from delving into the history of Australia. But what we're going to get today is an aspect of history which will be fresh and new to people in Sydney. A different story altogether from a different branch of the same order. So, John, it's a great pleasure and privilege to have you here. And welcome, and could I call on you to address the society.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk about New Norcia, with which I've had a lifelong association. My father was the manager of a superphosphate factory in Perth, and he supplied superphosphate for the farm at New Norcia. And very often, or each year, the farm manager, when he drove down to Perth to pick up the superphosphate order, would come to our home for dinner, and so he became quite a close friend. And on the occasion of my sister's birthday, I think it was her 10th birthday, he bought her a little piece of music. It was called Gavotte in C, which had been specially composed for her by the great organist and composer from New Norcia, Dom Stephen Moreno. So, and then following on that association, as a priest in Perth, I was a frequent visitor. In fact, I was one of the few Perth priests who really maintained contact with the monastery at Eunorcia. The Irish priests really just weren't interested. Anyway, just to give you an idea of the layout of the town of Eunorcia and a feel for the kind of buildings that are there, along with Steve, we've put together just this Cook's tour, if you like, of Eunorcia. I'll just pick out for you the main items. This is the Moore River, and it was on the banks of the Moore River that Don Salvado came, met the local Aborigines, the Moore people, and started a farm. Here you've got the garden, olive groves, orchard and so on associated with the monastery. This is the rear of the monastery building. It faces in this direction, and here's the main gate leading into the monastery. Across from the monastery is the cathedral. That's the courtyard, of the monastery cloister. Of a statue of St. Benedict, and behind him is the balcony of the Lord Abbot's quarters. And then across from is the cathedral, which dates from the original part of the cathedral was built in Salvado's time, and then this facade was added later. Directly up from the cathedral, on the main axis of the town, this is the east-west axis, is the cemetery. And it's important that you keep this in mind, because this is the site where the new cathedral was to be built, over the top of the cemetery, so that the cemetery would then form the sort of crypt of the new cathedral. And the foundation stone of the new cathedral, which I'll be talking about, was laid just in that point there. Over here is the Boys' College, which was built by Abbot Torres in about 1905 and staffed by the Maris brothers for many years. It's called St. Ildefonsus. As you can see, it's a sort of a Romanesque style. To match that, on this side is the Girls' College, St. Gertrude's, built about the same time. It's more of a Gothic style, and it was staffed by the Josephite nuns. Here is the orphanages on this side for girls and Aboriginal boys on this side. In the middle, the convent for an order of Aboriginal nuns who cared for them. This now has been turned into the museum and art gallery. This is a typical building, one of the farm buildings, probably this one over here. Typical sort of vernacular style, mainly built out of mud and brick. And then there were many buildings of this type all across this area where the Aboriginal farmers lived. Over in this corner is the Marian Shrine, just here, which was built for the 1951 visit of the Fatima statue. And this building here, which is on the screen now, is the hostel, which was built in the 1920s by the local monk architect, Dom Urban, to house visitors to Eunorcia. It's now a licensed hotel, and just in front of it, there's a general store post office to service the town. The main road goes right through the middle of the town, across here. And for many years, it was sort of very noisy. It's the main road north to Geraldton, but in more recent years it now bypasses the town, and of course it's much quieter. This is the tomb of Salvato inside at the rear of part of the cathedral, the choir of the cathedral, where the monks are. But please keep in mind the cemetery here in the middle. And what you have to imagine is this very stark modernist cathedral set down in the middle of this group of historical buildings, which have got a much more traditional feel about them. Okay, so my title is Cathedral Folly, the origin of the 1960 plan to build a brutalist-style cathedral at New Norcia. And let me begin by just clarifying some terminology. The term folly is used as it is used in landscape architecture to describe extravagant, over-the-top gazebos or decorative features. It's not meant to sort of imply blame on anybody. The term brutalist doesn't mean ugly or menacing. It's a mistranslation of the French phrase béton brut, which means raw concrete. The building materials are simply exposed and not covered up. The best way to think of brutalist buildings is as huge geometric sculptures, like the former Qantas building, which is just across the road, and you get a marvellous view of it from the courtyard. It's a wonderful piece of sculpture. My first visit to New Norcia was as a young seminarian in May 1946, on an excursion from St. Charles Seminary in Perth. It was part of the centenary celebrations of the Diocese of Perth and the Benedictine Mission at New Norcia. At New Norcia, I remember being shown the foundation stone for the new cathedral, which is seen here in this photo. It was located on the lower edge of the cemetery, on the central axis facing the old cathedral and the monastery. The stone had been solemnly blessed by Cardinal Gilroy the previous Saturday. The new cardinal had come to Perth with an entourage of Australian bishops to preside at the centenary celebrations. The previous week, on a moonlight night in Perth, I had been one of six torchbearers escorting the cardinal in his flowing scarlet robes as he processed across the Subiaco Oval to an outdoor altar. With the trumpet sounds of Verdi's triumphal march from Aida blaring out over the loudspeakers, it was my first experience of grand opera. The foundation stone that was laid by the cardinal back in 1946 was for this cathedral, designed during the war by the resident monk architect Dom Urban Gimeneth. It's officially described as being in the English classical style, reminiscent of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. It would have been 100 metres long and about 50 metres high, so nearly three times higher than the existing cathedral belfry. It's a very elegant design, and being built as it would have been in sort of grey cement, it would have blended in quite well with the historical atmosphere of the town. It was announced that the building would commence as soon as the wartime shortages of materials ceased. But this 1946 plan wasn't the first attempt to build a new cathedral at New Norcia. Abbot Torres, who was appointed in 1900, drew up a plan, and he probably would have implemented it had he not died unexpectedly in 1915. In 1918, the priest architect from Geraldton, Father John Hawes, wrote to Abbot Catalan, recommending most highly a foreman mason, Mr. Joseph Bailey, for any work you may have, such as building your cathedral. In a much later letter, Hawes says that he'd drawn up plans for a Baroque cathedral at the request of Abbot Catalan. It had been replaced by a new plan. This was probably the design by the abbot visitor from Rome, Abbot Guzzi, who visited Eunorcia around 1935. He was pushing Abbot Catalan to get started on a new cathedral. And as we have seen, finally, in 1946, the foundation stone for the long-awaited new cathedral was laid. This raises two questions. Why did the monastery church, serving a small country town, have the title cathedral? And secondly, why were successive abbots after Salvado continually preoccupied with building a new and more impressive cathedral? In answer to these questions, we need to go back to the founder of Eunorcia, Dom Rosendo Salvado, later Bishop Salvado, who enshrined and nurtured its genius loci. And here I'm indebted to my former Manly colleague, George Russo, for his 1980 biography of Salvado, Lord Abbot of the Wilderness, based on Salvado's diaries and detailed records, which are preserved in the Eunorcia archives. I've also drawn on Odran O'Brien's detailed account of the dispute between Bishop Serra and Bishop Salvado in his biography of Martin Griver, the third Bishop of Perth. Salvado was born into a noble, music-loving family in Galicia in northern Spain. At age 15, he entered the famous monastery of St. Martin at Compostela. After his profession as a monk, he did a two-year course in organ playing and was appointed organist of the abbey. He was a talented pianist and composer, which played an important role in his later life in Western Australia. In 1836, the anti-clerical government in Spain closed the monasteries and secularized the monks. Salvado made his way to Italy and was accepted into the Benedictine monastery at Cava near Naples. He was ordained a priest and returned and resumed his role as the monastery organist. He then met up with an Irish bishop, John Brady, the newly appointed first bishop of Perth, who was looking for missionaries for his diocese. Along with fellow Spanish Benedictine priest José Serra and a group of brothers, Salvado sailed with Brady from London and arrived in Perth in January 1846. The missionaries moved north, made contact with the Maura people on the banks of the small river, later called the Moore River, and they started clearing land for a farm. Serra was the senior priest and in charge, but he was a rather delicate academic type and soon returned to Perth, where he became vicar general and later successor to the insolvent Bishop Brady. Salvado then became the de facto founder and guiding spirit of the Eunorcia mission. There were two sides to Salvado's character. On the one hand, the missionary priest, with a genuine empathy and respect for the dignity and potential of the Aboriginal people. Dressed in dungarees, he sat around the campfire with them in the evening, listening to their stories, writing down words and songs, and starting a dictionary. At a piano recital he gave in Perth to raise funds, he mimicked their songs and the sounds of a corroboree and raised £70. His plan was to develop their skills as tradesmen and farmers and give them ownership of small farms. At the height of his success, there were 22 Aboriginal families forming a village near the monastery, working their farms nearby, sharing in the cultural life of the monastic town with a cricket team, always winning against Perth, a brass band and a string orchestra. The telegraph office had an Aboriginal postmistress to whom Salvado proudly taught Morse code. This illustration from 1870 shows the growth of the monastery and also the extension of the number of Aboriginal farmers living in the village. Meanwhile, in Perth, Sarah, following the age-old Benedictine missionary model, established a second monastery on 300 acres of land near the edge of the city. He planted 60,000 vines, olive groves, and fruit trees. The monks ministered to the small Catholic communities in Perth and Fremantle, supplied produce to the bishop's house, and he also had plans for a third monastery at Dardanup near Bunbury to minister to the southwest of the state. Salvado became increasingly concerned that the resources of men and money coming from Spain, largely through his contacts, were being diverted away from New Norcia and the mission to the Aborigines. The problem was exacerbated by the fact that the land grant and all the property at New Norcia legally belonged to the Bishop of Perth. After several years of correspondence and personal lobbying in Rome, Salvado secured the complete independence of New Norcia from the Diocese of Perth. In 1867, it was given the coveted title of Abbey Nullius Diocesis, usually just called Abbey Nullius, with its own parishes in nearby towns. This was later extended to 30,000 square miles, stretching south to Bindoon, north to Moora, and east into the rich wheat and sheep belt as far as Southern Cross. Salvado was given the title of Vicar Apostolic and appointed Lord Abbot for life. The second side of Salvado's character was his role as one of the leading figures in the European Benedictine hierarchy. On a visit to Rome in 1849, Salvado was unexpectedly nominated as bishop of the new British settlement of Port Victoria near present-day Darwin. By the time news got back to Rome that the British had abandoned the settlement, Salvado had already been consecrated as its bishop. After some doubt about his future, at one stage it was proposed that he should become an assistant to Poulding in Sydney, he was allowed to return to New Norcia with the added prestige of being a bishop. And so the Abbey Church, became a cathedral with an episcopal throne. One of his aims in Europe was to establish a college attached to one of the great Spanish monasteries in order to recruit novices for New Norcia. On a visit to Spain in 1867, through his brother Santos, who was also a priest and confessor to Queen Isabella, Salvado had extensive discussions with the Queen about his plans to perpetuate Spanish culture at New Norcia. And the Queen nominated him to be the president of the Escorial, the great monastic complex outside Madrid, housing the tomb of Charles V, and a prestigious college which could recruit novices for New Norcia. George Russo says, quote, "News spread to other parts of the Benedictine world, and the results were enormous. The news excited New Norcia like the forecast of rain during a drought. Salvado had no qualms about being able to combine the two positions, which would have made New Norcia one of the most prestigious abbeys of the Benedictine world. But the papal nuncio to Madrid thought otherwise and had the appointment cancelled. Salvado appealed to Rome, but his appeal was rejected, and he was ordered to return to New Norcia. On his way home, he made visits to the great Benedictine abbeys of Salem in France, which was restoring Gregorian chant, to Malines in Belgium, and Downside in England, where he arranged for a monk to act as his buying agent for books and works of art. Although he continued to promote Aboriginal welfare, Russo says, quote, "From the 1870s, life was prosperous and more settled, and Salvado could concentrate on making New Norcia the cultural centre that he always hoped it would become. The Abbey farms became the most modern and prosperous in Western Australia, with pastoral leases of 900,000 acres. Foremost amongst his concerns was establishing a library worthy of a great abbey. George Russo devotes a whole chapter entitled A Library in the Desert to it. I visited the library as a student in 1950 and marvelled at the 260 volumes of Ming's Petrology in Greek and Latin, a 15th century edition of St. Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologica, rare editions of the Bible, and copious works on art, architecture, literature, and all the contemporary reviews, particularly from the English world. From his experience of the great abbeys of Europe, Salvado understood that the two distinguishing features of Benedictine abbeys were their libraries and their impressive churches. So I think it's reasonable to assume that Salvado had the same ambition for New Norcia. In 1899, aged 85, Salvado travelled to Rome to celebrate his golden jubilee as a bishop. In Rome, he heard that his assistant abbot, an expected successor in New Norcia, Prior Domingue, had died. He had already been impressed by a monk from Montserrat, Dom Fulgentius Torres, with whom he spent some time in Naples, and he proposed that Torres should be his successor and return with him to New Norcia. It's reasonable to assume that he would have outlined to Torres his vision and plans for New Norcia, including the building of an impressive new cathedral to replace the modest church, which was one of the oldest buildings in the town. Torres was with Salvado in Rome when he died unexpectedly in December 1900, and he returned to New Norcia to implement Salvado's plans. The community brought Salvado's body back to New Norcia and interned it in the abbey, where it remains today. As I mentioned, I visited New Norcia in February 1950 to study in the library. Walking around the town, I noticed that the foundation stone for the new cathedral, laid with great ceremony in 1946, had been removed from the cemetery. I was told that it had been placed in a storeroom and that the cathedral project had been deferred due to Abbot Catalan's age. I recently asked the archivist Peter Hocking, did he have any knowledge of where the foundation stone was, but he told me he can't find any trace of it. It seems that it may have been taken away by a builder and broken up. I could be one of the last surviving witnesses who actually saw it. My next visit to New Norcia was in 1951. On Thursday, January the 12th, 1951, an article appeared in the West Australian newspaper announcing that the pilgrim statue of Our Lady of Fatima had arrived in Perth as part of a world anti-communist tour. She was to be taken from the Christian Brothers Farm School at Bindoon in a motorcade on Saturday night and feted with a high mass at Eunorsia on Sunday. I was a deacon sporting a Roman collar on holidays from Manly, and my mother, who saw the article, asked me to drive her and some of her friends to Eunorsia for the Sunday Mass. What puzzled me was that there was no mention of the pilgrim statue in Perth's Catholic paper, The Record, and no official reception of the statue in Perth. The clerical gossip was that this was because Archbishop Prendeville, possibly prompted by Cardinal Gilroy, was concerned that the Fatima message would be identified with the Menzies government's campaign to ban the Communist Party. Abbot Catalan had no such qualms, and several hundred pilgrims from Perth drove to Eunorsia for the Mass at an outdoor altar, as the cathedral was too small to accommodate the crowds. The Marian Shrine, which I mentioned, is still there. Similarly, bishops in the eastern states who supported the Santa Maria movement held huge rallies, culminating in 100,000 people, according to Archbishop Duhigg's notoriously elastic estimates, lining the streets of Brisbane, as seen in this photo. You'll be interested to know, by the way, that our president is in the tableau, and we might get him to explain it to us later. All of this may seem irrelevant to my subject matter, except that the reports of the huge rallies got back to Eunorsia, and the idea took hold, especially in the mind of the newly appointed abbot, Gregory Gomez, that Eunorsia could become a pilgrimage centre, attracting pilgrims from all over Australia and even internationally. And of course, a new and bigger cathedral would be needed. It's also important to remember that pilgrimages were very much part of popular Catholic culture in the 1950s. 1950 had been declared a holy year by Pius XII, and 700 Australians, led by Archbishop Duhigg, formed the Australian National Pilgrimage to Rome, Lourdes, Fatima, and Ireland. Abbot Gomez was Spanish, but with a difference. He was a novice at Montserrat and continued his studies at Eunorsia. But he was sent to study theology for 4 years with Australian students at Manly, and imbibed some Australian traits. He then studied for a doctorate at the Benedictine University in Rome, and most significantly spent 2 years at the famous German Benedictine Abbey at Maria Lark, which, under Abbot Hoegen, was one of the leading centres of the pre-war movement for the reform and revitalisation of the liturgy. Gomez's entry in the Australian Dictionary of Biography says, quote, "His term was marked by openness to new ideas and readiness to consult." One of the most revealing documents, which the Eunorsia archivist Peter Hocking made available to me, are some extracts from the community diary of the monks. It's almost like a daily gossip column. The entry for April the 1st, 1955 reads, quote, "Abbot Gomez this afternoon called a meeting of all solemnly professed monks to cast their votes on a decision of paramount importance for the future development of New Norcia Abbey, namely the building of a new church in conformity with the liturgy and a new monastery. It was decided to call tenders for plans and specifications amongst architects in Australia, Europe, and America. Note the phrase, a new church in conformity with the liturgy. 1955 was the year the new Easter liturgy was introduced, and it's reasonable to conclude that what prompted Abbot Gomez to suddenly revive the cathedral project in New Norcia was the need for a more suitable space to carry out the new Holy Week liturgy. I can remember that this is what the cathedral interior looked like in 1955. It certainly needed a makeover. 6 months later, the monastery diary records no further mention of tenders or meetings. However, the idea of a new cathedral was still alive, and on Wednesday, May the 8th, 1957, the diary records, quote, today a sketch model of the future cathedral has been shown to the community. And on October the 4th, 1957, quote, Abbot Gomez to Rome to discuss the cathedral. He was away from New Norcia for 9 months. In Rome, he discussed the project with Abbot Guzzi, who was now the Abbot Primate, who had visited New Norcia in 1935 and, as I mentioned, had drawn up a plan for Abbot Catalan to implement. This time, Abbot Guzzi referred Gomez to the recently established Institute of Liturgical Art, which was an offshoot of the liturgical movement. The aim of the institute was to involve modern architects in church design and experiment with new layouts for churches to suit changes to the liturgy, especially greater participation by the laity. Leading up to the Vatican Council, this was part of a change to the mindset of the church from that of a monarchical institution ruled by bishops and priests to that of a community of believers served by priests and bishops. Think of the symbolism of the Holy Thursday liturgy, bishops and priests washing the feet of the laity. I'm not sure whether women get their feet washed. This led to the rethinking of the shape of churches, particularly with the altar in the centre of circular or oval-shaped churches, with the congregation gathered around it as a community, with priests facing the people and speaking their language. Many of you may remember the beginnings of the liturgical movement here in Sydney, led by priests like Roger Pryke, Tony Newman, Ted Kennedy, and other young priests, who founded the Living Parish Movement, which commissioned the Living Parish Hymnal from Dick Conley and James Macaulay. Bishop Guildford Young commissioned sculptor Tom Bass to design the altar, baptism font, and statuary for his new church in Yass, to name just a few examples. The Jesuit Father Michael Kelly helped found the Blake Prize for Religious Art. All this thinking about the liturgy was eventually enshrined in the decree on the liturgy at the first session of the Vatican Council in 1962. Meanwhile, following several weeks of discussion with Abbot Gomez, the Institute of Liturgical Art issued the following enthusiastic statement. Quote, in the autumn of 1957, the International Institute of Liturgical Art has been presented with a greater challenge than any it has previously undertaken. This is the construction of a completely new cathedral and abbey to be erected at New Norcia in Australia. The Institute has selected a team of architects and civil engineers to be led by Professor Luigi Nervi, an architect of international renown. The Institute is now preparing to carry out the whole project at New Norcia, from the planning to the actual direction of the work, and finally, with the aid of world-famous artists, the interior decoration. It is a most arduous task. The Institute has for the first time the opportunity to create from start to finish a church which is to be the sum of all its experience and ideals and which will be a living expression of the religious faith of our age. No wonder Abbot Gomez seems to have been swept off his feet by an offer which was too good to refuse. Nervi was the inventor of reinforced concrete, which made it possible to span much larger spaces with lighter and more elegant structures. He'd already been the structural engineer for the roof of a new church at St. John's Benedictine Abbey at Collegeville in Minnesota, the center of the liturgical movement in the United States. He'd also been co-designer of the new underground basilica at Lourdes and of the stadium for the Rome Olympics. He was to be assisted by a leading Italian architect, Carlo Vernoni, who was to design the monastery. More than 6 months later, on June the 1st, Abbot Gomez arrived back in New Norcia with well-advanced drawings of the project. The community diary for June the 2nd, 1958, reads, Thursday, June the 2nd. In the afternoon, the Lord Abbot calls a meeting of the community to explore the feelings of the monks about the idea of the future cathedral presented by the Institute of Liturgical Art. These were some of the drawings shown to what were probably the surprised monks. It's interesting that there's a modern car in the photo. I don't know whether the people at the Institute knew that Abbot Gomez had a taste for fast cars. In fact, he eventually died speeding up the Bindoon Hill and crashed his car. Anyway, the diary records their reaction. All were in agreement that the cathedral is necessary, even if costly. The only exception was the old Abbot Catalan, who, with excessive caution to spend money, thinks that we should wait until we have in hand every penny that will be required. He thinks it is a ridiculous vanity. Then, in September, two beautiful models arrived by boat from Italy. The parabolic arch of the larger model was removable to give a view of the interior. The architect Vernoni arrived and detailed working drawings running into many pages, and he had discussions with the monks mainly about the positions of the altar and the furnishings. Vernoni also met with the civil engineer from the University of Western Australia, George Hondros, whom Abbot Gomez had appointed as the project manager to liaise with the Italian contractors, particularly for the parabolic arches which were to be built in Italy and shipped to Perth. Hondros also finalised the costs. In a letter to the Institute in July 1959, he estimated it to be £670,000. I won't try and translate that into modern-day dollars. He concludes his letter, "I am quite confident from discussions I've had with the Lord Abbot that he's aiming to raise the capital which makes the present project feasible." And the Lord Abbot was indeed busy trying to raise funds. The diary records that he had a meeting with Premier Hawke, Bob Hawke's uncle, and with Prime Minister Menzies to get some help in whatever form with the building of the cathedral. The entry for October the 23rd, 1959 says, quote, "The Lord Abbot had no luck at the bank. The Roman Institute wants money, and the bank refuses to advance it without guarantees. The Lord Abbot thought that what we wrote to him in Rome were groundless fears, but bankers are people who deal in hard facts." The other source of funds was to be the sale of 5 blocks of land in East Perth behind St Mary's Cathedral, which the monastery owned. It was residential and light industry, but the CBD was expected to develop in that direction, resulting in an increase in value up to more than £300,000. The diary for February 23, 1960 records, "Lord Abbot up and down to Perth in connection with the sale of the Godric Street land to get funds for the architects, but nothing doing." Despite these setbacks, the project was officially launched in April 1960 edition of PAX, the official organ of the Vicariate of New Norcia. Quote, "We are pleased to bring readers the first official information on the proposed new cathedral and monastery for New Norcia. The site has been chosen and has been cleared." The article, with a dramatic photo of the tri-fronted parabolic arch, goes on to describe the 3 great stained glass windows, each depicting a person of the Trinity. The article concludes, "The beauty of the surroundings will match the beauty of the cathedral, which we will soon see, God willing. The prayers and financial support of all are earnestly invited for this great work." Similar short articles appeared in the Catholic press in Perth, Adelaide, Sydney, and Melbourne. I'd left Perth by then and was at the Dominican Priory in Melbourne. I don't recall much interest in the New Norcia project amongst my clerical colleagues in the liturgical movement in the eastern states. They were more concerned with parish liturgy rather than monastic liturgy. By contrast, the announcement created intense interest in architectural circles. The June 1960 edition of the magazine Architecture Today had a photo cover and feature article welcoming, quote, "Australia's first Nervian structure." There was enthusiastic coverage of the project in New York and in Italy. In Sydney, Harry Seidler, prompted by the New Norcia project, engaged Nervi as the structural engineer for his Australia Square project. To launch the public appeal, the models were placed on exhibition in Bones Department Store in Perth. But even that didn't seem to go well. As the diary notes, "We thought the entrance fee would be the beginning of the building fund, but we read in the paper today that it was to help paraplegic children." Archbishop Prendeville gave £100, and typical of an archivist, Peter Hocking has kept his father's receipt for a £10 donation. However, the 1960s were a time of expanding suburbs in Perth, and new schools and churches had a much higher priority than New Norcia's glamorous cathedral and monastery. From 1961 to 1964, the blocks of land in East Perth were sold one by one, but the funds were insufficient to commence building, and the Nervi plans were quietly filed away for posterity. One last effort was made to give New Norcia its coveted cathedral. Perth architects Henderson and Thompson were commissioned to produce a smaller building and came up with a more traditional rectangular design. But again, rising building costs and the declining number of monks coming from Spain dampened enthusiasm for it to proceed. Due to a shortage of priests, the parishes were gradually handed back to Perth. And in 1980, New Norcia lost its cherished status as an Abbey Nullius, and the Abbey Church ceased to be a cathedral. The elaborately carved Abbot's Throne is now in the museum. Abbot Gomez retired in 1971 and died in a car accident in 1995. The entry in the ADB says that his successor, quote, Abbot Rooney recalled that his lightheartedness in failure and disappointment meant that he never lost a wink of sleep through worry. Fortunately, the detailed plans and the models were preserved in the monastery archives and were catalogued by Peter Hocking when he became the archivist in 2007. Academic interest in the Nervi Cathedral was rekindled in 2012 by Dr. Annette Candello of the Architecture Faculty at Curtin University. She saw a reference to the New Norcia project in a book on Nervi, which she bought in a bookshop in Kuala Lumpur. She made a detailed study of the archival material at New Norcia and delivered a report on her research at a symposium entitled Unbuilt Perth, organised by the Architecture Faculty at the University of Western Australia. In 2014, the faculty, led by René Van Muyen, produced a pioneering virtual reality video of the model, capturing the feeling of being inside the building, which was shown at the Venice Architectural Biennale, accompanied by an explanatory essay by Annette Candello. It's thanks to Dr. Candello that the Nervi project has a permanent and distinguished place in Australia's architectural history. One puzzling item that remains is that in 1960, in an interview with the Melbourne Herald, the Perth project manager, George Hondros, stated that the three huge stained glass windows designed by the Swiss architect Willy Kaufmann and the five great bronze doors had already been manufactured in Rome and were in storage in the Vatican, ready to be shipped to New Norcia when the building was ready. As far as I know, no one from New Norcia seems to have tried to locate them in the Vatican. One wonders who would have paid for them, and really, are they still there? Thanks to the effort of Peter Hocking, the smaller model and the images of the Nervi Cathedral and the Abbey are now permanently on display in the museum, and there will be a lasting memorial to his outstanding work as the archivist since 2007. The monastery community now consists of just 10 monks, two of whom are in a nursing home in Perth. Tourism is the main focus of the town. I suspect that the abbot is grateful that the Nervi Cathedral and monastery did not eventuate, as finding a suitable use for it and the maintenance costs would be an enormous burden. And one final thought bubble. There is no custom-designed Catholic cathedral in Canberra. St. Christopher's Cathedral in Manuka is just an upgraded parish church. On the left-hand side of the road leading onto Commonwealth Avenue, onto Commonwealth Bridge, there is a magnificent site set aside for a Catholic cathedral – directly across the lake from the National Library. If, at this late stage, the Church ever decides to build a national cathedral or a national centre in Canberra, the Nervi Cathedral, with some interior modifications, would be an outstanding addition to the modernist skyline of Canberra. Thank you, and thanks particularly to Steve for his contribution, without whom this talk would quickly have degenerated into John's folly. Thank you. So can I ask the first question? That's to ask you to explain how you came to be in this tableau as Jacinta?
Lucia.
Lucia. How did that come about?
Well, I was a sweet little boy, wasn't I? This is me here. I was then a boarding student at St. Joseph's College, Nudgee, and our school were asked to provide the transport for this pilgrim statue when it came to Australia, came to Brisbane, rather. And it was built on the back, as you could see, of a decorated, disguised Dodge utility, and three of the students were got up, as I said in a chapter in a book some years ago, to the nearest replica that their parents could devise of peasant Portuguese costume. My principal recollection, all this here is spun glass. The clouds of heaven were provided by spun glass. I can remember having that in my knees and hands for weeks afterwards. And it made the constant kneeling, which we Christian Brothers boys had to do in the 1950s, incredibly uncomfortable. But as you can see, there are a lot of people there, including the boys in blue, Queensland's finest. They've got hats on, so we can't see whether they've got Peter Dutton haircuts or not. But Peter Dutton is a typical Queensland copper. I'll leave that for that further comment. This is Bill Coman, who later became... I think it's Bill Coman, who later became a leading ENT surgeon in Brisbane. So there's no doubt where religious education can lead you. But that was 1951, taken at Eagle Farm Airport, just after the statue was arrived. It was bolted to the deck of that little platform on the deck of the thing, and that's my first public cross-dressing appearance.
Are there any other questions of a more serious nature?
That was an excellent talk from my perspective. Thank you so much. Can you fill me in as a tourist round about the early 2000s from Perth up to the Pinnacles on a bus trip? We were taken to New Norcia. The Abbey was closed, so we couldn't get much further than the front gate. My memory is that opposite the Abbey, we were taken to what they told us was the official church. I was absolutely heartbroken. It looked very homemade, timber, very brutalist, I suppose, very male, like as if they'd carved the beams and the pews with hand chisels, and it was quite small. When was that built, and is that the official church now?
Yes, it is. That's the... I meant to try and get a photo. After Abbot Gomez's time... The next abbot, who was an Australian, I've forgotten his name, that building is the original building which was built in Salvado's time. And then it was extended at the back. But to modernise it, as happens in so many churches, all the existing fittings were ripped out and... It had a simple altar at the crossing and pews and so on. And as I remember, there were Stations of the Cross sort of painted onto the wall. So it's an upgraded building, but the actual building itself dates back to Salvado's time.
Thank you very much, John. It's very, very enjoyable and informative. There was just one comment when you wondered what it would cost in today's terms. I quickly used the RBA calculator, and the sum would have been £600,000 in 1961, would amount to $18,314,377 in today's. The follow-up question I had was, is there anything in Salvador's diary about the first contacts between the Aboriginal community and Salvado and the people that were...
Yes, I have to confess, I haven't read the diaries, but I'm sure there is. And it's mentioned, as Ed will confirm, particularly in George Russo's book. But yes, the diaries were translated. They were in Spanish originally, and they were published, I think, in London or in Europe in 1847. And subsequently, the Jesuit at Stormen, yes, translated them into English, and they were published, yes. But I confess I haven't read them, but they do, I'm sure, give detailed accounts of his associations with the Aborigines. Yes, he was regarded as being very enlightened and very advanced in his treatment of the Aborigines. Florence Nightingale sent out a circular around the British Empire for reports on native missions, and she was very impressed by Salvado's reports and carried on a correspondence with him. Talking about money, I read recently the monastery still owns 7,000 hectares of prime agricultural land east of the monastery, and it's been leased out to local farmers. But I read recently that Twiggy Forest wants to buy it because there's a shortage of agricultural land in Western Australia, and he's offered the monastery $40 million for the land. Anyway, that's by the by. Mm-hmm.
John, you mentioned that there was a site in Canberra which had been set aside. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, all I know about it is the site where the Archbishop's House is. As you drive along Commonwealth Avenue, coming towards the bridge, next to that was set aside as the site for the Catholic Cathedral.
John, as you may know, there is a partly similar case in Cairns where the earlier cathedral from the late 20s in a Spanish mission style still exists, but next to it is a vast red brick late 60s replacement cathedral. Okay. With some striking stained glass, although my overwhelming impression was how glaringly unsuitable it looked to the setting and the climate, but certainly very ambitious for the period.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, we have here in Sydney at Parramatta, the new St Patrick's Cathedral at Parramatta is a perfect example of what a new style Catholic Church should be. As you remember, the St Patrick's Church was gutted by fire, and the shell of the Gothic shell remained. The bishop at the Kevin Manning, who was very enlightened, and he engaged Romolo Gugola, the designer of the new Parliament House, to design. Yes, here's some pictures of it. To design this new cathedral for Parramatta. And so what they did was turn the existing Gothic piece into a chapel with the Blessed Sacrament Chapel and the baptistry, including a walk-in baptistry. There it is there. And then the modern section, there you can see it, and a very humble bishop's chair at ground floor level, right at the end of the building. It's a very beautiful building and well worth a visit.
John, it brings to mind another folly, in the more popular sense of the word, the Holy Name Cathedral, which was proposed by Duhigg in Brisbane. was never built. He built a crypt quickly so that it could be regarded as a place of worship and escape council rates. But it's said, it used to be said in Brisbane that he lost all this money on Roma oil shares and was eventually sued by a relative, the architect who was a relative, I think, and he lost the case in Brisbane. I can remember how scandalised the Catholic community in Brisbane were that the judges actually stuck to the law instead of standing by the Archbishop.
Yes, you might remember that my original title, which I proposed, was Cathedral Follies. It was in the plural. And I was going to talk about three 20th century examples, New Norcia, Brisbane, and, of course, the famous Liverpool Cathedral, which the Irish Archbishop Downey wanted to build to outstrip the famous Liverpool Cathedral of Charles Gilbert Scott. And the same thing happened. The crypt was built. The most fantastic model of it was built. But the war came, the money couldn't be raised. And after the war, quite a famous modern cathedral was built on the crypt. It's referred to as the Wigwam. It's in the shape of a circle, altar in the centre, and so on. So, but fortunately, the Dewey plan failed. It was quite a pedestrian design. They patented a special kind of brick for it to be built out of, and it was to sit just on the hill in Fortitude Valley, dominating the whole of Brisbane. I think it would have been an embarrassment. Mm.
That was fabulous, John, the talk. Thanks very much. Could I just add, apropos of the Brisbane fiasco, Jack's talking about the loss of the money on Roma oil. My Anglican wife assures me that the tradition in her tribe is that the money was collected and sent to Rome to be blessed by the Pope, but it never came back.
Well, I suppose that might have caused it to multiply.
I might add, too, that my grandfather donated £100 and he paid for one of those, I can't quite remember, I think they're horse troughs, or the residual bits of whatever were built on that cathedral site. I think they're still there. They might be stone benches, but some other Queenslander might have a better memory. But he did his dash on that too, I'm afraid.
He wouldn't have been the first one who did his dash by putting his faith in James Dewig, but we'll let that
somebody
be.
Somebody over there, John.
Thank you for a very engaging talk. That was fabulous. Could you expand a bit more about the circular you just mentioned, issued or published on behalf of Florence Nightingale, seeking information about foreign missions?
Look, I suggest that you look up George Russo's book. That's really all the details of it that I can remember, but that's where it's referred to. Mm-hmm.
Any honours of any kind for the work that he's done as archivist?
Well, he only just retired in October, and he really has done a superb job as the archivist at New Norcia. No, I'm not sure of any recognition that he's got.
Are they replacing him?
I presume so. Mm. Yeah. The archives in New Norcia are really first rate. Mm.
Thank you.
Well, I think we might draw formal proceedings to a close. Okay. Thank you all very much.
Okay.
We've been listening to the former Dominican theologian, head of the ABC Science Unit, and the ABC's International Relations Executive, Dr. John Challis, addressed the topic Cathedral Folly, the Origin of the 1960 Plan to Build a Brutalist-Style Cathedral at New Norcia. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. The ACHS podcast is recorded and produced by me, John Kenny. In April, with Easter falling on what would normally be the Society's meeting day, we will meet a week earlier on 10 April to hear the Rare Books Librarian at the Australian Catholic University, Dr. Hugh Myers, speak about the University's Rare Books Collection. That collection was sponsored by the recently retired Vice-Chancellor Greg Craven.
We can expect to hear something of the historical uses to which the collection is being put and is expected to be put in future. We look forward to having you along for that talk. Until then, please stay well.